session number 27074, reel 7.
Squadron leader Cyril Bamberger, reel 7.
The brief combat I've just commented on is difficult for me to remember details, but of course it was the first time I'd seen these yellow-nosed 109s. They look much more frightening than our Spitfires. The job of the squadron was to go after the 109s, not bombers. And they nearly always were above us. They'd come across the channel at height, and they dived at us at speed, carried on diving and headed for home, depending whether success or not, or pulled up into the sun again. So when I got this opportunity to shoot at an aircraft, obviously it's an aspiring air race, I'd have liked to have shot it down and confirmed it was shot down. But to start with hindsight, I was probably shooting way out of range. I say in my report 250 yards. I should think if I was as close as 500, I was lucky. Black smoke that came was probably due to the petrol injection of the 109s and him opening his throttle. It probably had nothing to do with the damage I may or may not have done to the aircraft. There was a chance I hit him, but I say it's only a chance. But of course, one was, I say, you use the word adrenaline these days, adrenaline was flowing. But I was obviously also scared to death, because I didn't know what was going on. And certainly in my earlier combats during the Battle of Britain, I frequently, in fact more often than not, found myself still orbiting at whatever height, 25,000 feet, and not another aircraft in sight, because they'd all mostly gone diving down. I tried it a few times at the period I'm talking about, and to pursue a 109 over the channel was almost a waste of time, unless you were very close to him, because with the petrol injection they got away so fast. If you push your stick down, your engine cut, and by the time it had recovered again, you'd probably lost sight of him anyway. So it was exciting, scary, bewildering, all at the same time.
Were there any kind of rules that you were trying to work to when that? Because obviously you mentioned you didn't watch him go down, but you wouldn't be flying very straight and level for very long during combat.
The one thing you did learn very quickly, that you never flew straight and level. Now the point is, if you pull the aircraft around in a tight turn, as you normally did, if there was a lot of enemy aircraft around, you wanted to see someone on your tail. Because in these combats, there was lots of tracer flying about. And it was mostly probably from Spitfires, but you didn't know who it was from. There was a total confusion quite often. And the thing, if you'd pull the aircraft around fairly tightly, you lost most of your speed. And the thing you wanted up there was speed. So the next thing I'd be doing, as well as weaving and twisting, would be diving down, trying to get some speed up. So I felt as if you were in control of the situation, and perhaps if you saw something else, you could do something about it. But if you're almost stalling at about 120 miles an hour, you're no use to anybody, you're just a target.
Would the squadron be able to reform from it after such an action?
In the majority of cases, after meeting the enemy, the squadron never reformed. Occasionally, if you're heading to base, you'd see someone heading to base and you'd join up. You may find three or four joined up. But mostly, you just, landed at base when you got to base.
And you mentioned, obviously, during the air combat, trying to work out if there was anybody on your tail. Was there anything within the cockpit that would give you any kind of indication of what was behind?
I cannot remember what time. Maybe when I joined the cockpit, the squadron, we had mirrors sometimes inside the cockpit, sometimes outside the cockpit. But at the immediate time, you know there are enemy aircraft about. It's pretty, almost, it's like if you're driving a car. You've got to look into a mirror to see if there's I'd sooner do a steep turn than be gazing into a mirror. So I can't say that I've ever seen an enemy aircraft in my mirror. Probably if I had it done, I'd have been dead.
And a little bit about firing your weapons. Could you explain to me how the sights worked and what armament the Spitfire had?
Well, if I recollect correctly, you can obviously find this out. I think we had something like 13 seconds, 12 or 13 seconds of firing with our 8 Browning machine guns, some of which had tracer in, others were just armor piercing. We obviously had not had, or I had not had, an awful lot of gunnery training, and certainly never seen before. I may have done it, seen it harden, but I didn't use it. The gunnery sights that we had in the Spitfires. I can't remember exactly what it had. It was an illuminated cross, I think, with a ring in the middle. But when you were firing at an aircraft, even in these early days in my total ignorance, I knew about deflection shooting. And if an aircraft you were firing at was in a turn, then it was no use shooting at the aircraft, otherwise all your ammunition will go. So you had to get a lead on him, and you had to pull through his line of flight, get ahead of him and fire. And that's why the tracer helped a little in the early days, because you could fire your guns and wave the tracer through him and get a lead using your tracer to guide you. But I'm talking about the early days when you were learning on the job, and it was a steep learning curve, and the majority, not the majority, but a great number of the casualties in the Battle of Britain amongst inexperienced pilots came about in the first, 2 or 3 weeks, when they hadn't got, first of all, you had got to get the hang of not also shooting, but protecting yourself, because you were a dead pilot's no use to anybody.
It sounds very much like within the combat situation, that skills as a pilot, because you'd had quite a lot of airtime prior to the war and obviously during your training, that your skills as a pilot were very useful at that point, that you could also handle the aircraft in the sky. Was it important from a survival point of view that you had these skills to be able to fly that aircraft well?
By the time I joined my squadron, took part in the Battle of Britain, I had already clocked up on various aircraft 300 hours. I was very lucky. Some people had a great deal less. That I had so many hours was due to the fact of my flying in the Auxiliary Air Force before the war, and then the hold-up before we went to Hull Lavington. I wasted all that time and hours flying Magisters. That was a waste of time. But that was just how it worked out. But it was for my... In the end, it worked out to my own benefit, because I had... Obviously, I had greater confidence in my ability to fly the Spitfire than probably some other pilots. I'm not being boastful now. I was just lucky. But what I didn't know anything about air combat, and I didn't know anything about shooting, and basically I didn't know the limitations of the Spitfire. I'm probably jumping ahead here, but with an idea. If you were pursuing a 109, say trying to chase him across the channel and not have your engine cut out, what you could do is roll on your back of your aircraft and go down, sort of invert that, roll back, your engine wouldn't have cut out. But by the time I had the experience to do that, the 109 was out of sight, you see. Then another thing, you had fabric ailerons on the early Spitfires, and diving at speed, I can't say what speed, I can't recollect, the aircraft, I think, used to stop trying to turn to the left, I think. I hadn't got the physical strength at speed to straighten it up. Now, taking a stage further, how this learning on the job, I was on one occasion, I was definitely hit. Whether it was by friendly fire or just ammunition flying through the air, or whether it was something from one or not, I don't know. But I was definitely hit. And I'd obviously pulled my aircraft down in a very, very tight turn. And I found myself, I'll use the word spinning down. As I'd heard, my echo had definitely been hit. And there I was spinning down. I undid my straps to bail out. Then it suddenly dawned, which meant, of course, I was being tossed around the cockpit a bit. Then it dawned on me, I may just be in a spin. Well, I'd never been a spin in a Spitfire before. And so I restrapped myself in, somewhat bruised, and went through the what I'd been taught on a Hawker Hart, recovery from a spin. It seemed to take a long time, but I eventually came out of the spin. And so that in itself was a lesson. I will mention this point because I think it's probably debatable. But some people argue when Douglas Bader crashed in France, he'd gone into a spin and couldn't recover. So spinning Spitfires at the time I'm talking about was a debatable point. I don't think I ever discussed it with anybody, but I'd learned something new. I could get a Spitfire, I say, in a spin. It may have been some sort of out of control dive, I just don't know, but I recover, and that did my morale a load of good. But just to continue this little story to finish it off, I was flying then. I joined 41 Squadron at Hornchurch by this time, and I was flying back to Hornchurch, and I was so pleased with my performance that I nearly flew into the balloon barrage. I missed a balloon by a matter of feet, or the wires of a balloon by a matter of feet, and virtually climbed vertically to cover. I flew back to Hornchurch, and as I landed there, there was a twang, and both my ailerons drooped down. So it meant whoever had fired at me, or whatever had fired at me, had partly severed my controls, and the bump on landing shattered them. But as I taxied in, had a time to reflect on what had happened, if that had they broken, as I'd been coming into land, or even at 1,000 feet, or even higher. So it was a very sobering few moments taxiing in, and that was one flight. So you can pack an awful lot into one flight.
Sounds quite a strange thing, in the sense of you must have very little time to think clearly when you thought you were going into a spin, or you sent out a control dive. What kind of races through your mind at that time? Is it your training, or is it I need to get out of this aircraft?
Well, both were obviously going through my mind, otherwise I wouldn't have known. But it suddenly dawned on me that I may be able to get out of it. One of the things, you know, when you talk about fear and being scared, it was there all the time. But normally, as I described in that brief one flight, you were so preoccupied that in a way you hadn't got time to be scared. Until that bell rang and you had to go for another flight. When the bell rang, that shattered you. But once you were into the aircraft, you hadn't time to be shattered. You had something to do. You were preoccupied.
That's an interesting point, actually, because obviously when you're flying in the aerial combat situation, you're always preoccupied. What would you be doing all that time? What are the various factors of flying and fighting?
Well, you're listening to ground control, what they've got to say, and if they've got anything. You're turning your head through 360 degrees looking for the 109s, certainly in Spitfires. I won't talk about Hurricanes. But our brief on the Spitfires was look after the fighters. And the fighters, 90% of the time, had the advantage of height. So that's my experience. I don't talk about anybody else's. Then, of course, you occasionally glance down at your fuel, because obviously you weren't looking at your watch. And your example, I'd got into one of these melees or chaos in the sky, whatever you call them. I wouldn't call them dogfights, because they were over it too quickly. You know, we're talking about, you know, half a minute perhaps. You know, it's you aren't all whirling and twisting and doing that. That's just a figment of someone's imagination. Even pilots. I was on my own in the sky after one of these melees, and I looked my petrol gauges. I was nearly out of petrol. So I landed at Tangmere, and my home base at that time was Hornchurch. So in other words, you know, the things, you had to keep things like that. You didn't say, well, oh, now I'll head back for base, because you had to make sure you had the fuel to get back to base. And of course, you had to know where you were. That was the other thing, you see. I mean, sometimes you were above a cloud, you know. It may not be full cloud cover, it may be. Mostly it wasn't. But even if it's whatever, 9/10 cover, it's difficult to know where you are. So you had to know where you were. And then you had to find Tangmere or know where it was. So, you know, you had these, particularly when you were split up from the squadron, and you were nearly always, if you had got involved in a combat, you were split up.
I've often heard it said that in many occasions with pilots, when involved in combat, they would suddenly finish the attack and then there would be no aircraft in the sky. Is that something that you experienced?
Well, I think I touched on that briefly. I should think during the Battle of Britain, and I must mention this, I never once saw or fired on a bomber during the Battle of Britain. All I saw was 109s or 110s. And in this respect, I was doing what was my brief, and I suppose being of lowly rank, I thought I should stick to things or not. But I think a lot of other people gave that up and went looking for bombers, some easy things. But I didn't, never did. And so I think on every flight, I found myself on my own.
Could I ask you a little bit about the characteristics of the ME-109 as you saw it? How did it compare, say, with the Spitfire?
Well, the only... with my meetings with the 109s, they always were above, and they always had speed. We always seemed to be climbing up and hadn't got speed. So they tried to pick you off, and if things levelled out a little bit more and you were getting able to, they'd dive for home. And only on one or two occasions did I ever sort of... I don't think I ever caught up a 109, but I'd been close enough to him in the first place to do something about it. As regards our turning circle was better, we could turn inside them. So that was quite an advantage. But of course, if you're turning tight inside him, you're losing speed. And though he is on the, he's not losing so much speed. He had this petrol injection, which was a great advantage. Certainly, when he came up against such an inexperienced pilot as myself. The other thing is, I know I'm drifting a little, but learning from my experience with the rest of the war and other things, I mean, obviously, I should think most of the time I was firing out of range. But I'll make a bold statement. I should say 80% of the pilots during the Battle of Britain were firing out of range.
How difficult was it to judge range?
Judging range is not difficult at all if you've been taught and learned how to judge range. But jumping way ahead to 1943, where I was with another squadron, the Mediterranean, and I was a qualified fighter gunnery instructor taught by Sailor Milan. And I've got my log book, one of the proudest things I've got in there. Sailor Milan said I was an above average gunnery pilot, gunnery instructor. And I used to look, by that time, of course, all aircraft had cameras, guns. And so this is Mediterranean, 1944. I looked through the films, the combat films, of the squad, in fact, the wing, on time to time. And even then, 80% of the pilots were shooting out of range. So it had, nothing had changed.
Because I would imagine that that is a very, very difficult thing to judge at the speeds that you were approaching
well,
the aircraft
this,
with.
Obviously, many times you fired out of range. Now, going back to this, chasing them across the channel, even then, even though I was flying out of range, I fired my guns, hoping it would make him weave and slow down. So I wasted but I used ammunition, hoping it would slow him down. And I did that later in the war as well.
You mentioned obviously the Messerschmitt 110. Did you come up against them at all during your operations?
I only came up against the 110 once during the Battle of Britain. And the feature of the 110 at that time, and I can't tell you when it would be, it'd be September time, was that the whole squadron used to go into a defensive circle to defend one another. And on one particular occasion, our squadron, 41 squadron, we fly climbing up, and lo and behold, because remember we were still back flying these close formations. Though you looked around, you had to see. But what our squadron leader was doing at the time, I don't know. We threw right through the centre or up the centre, and these 110s were just going round. Well, they were going round at whatever speed, you know, say 250 miles or 350 miles, I don't know what speed they were orbiting at. And there we were at climbing speed, you know, virtually slow, staggering up. It only got one of them to turning a brumph. And so until you got some speed, you couldn't do anything. You couldn't risk climbing up through. So I took what was... I considered the sensible thing to do. I just rolled on my back and went straight down. There was no future. I didn't see it. Now, the only consolation I got was that I don't know what height I levelled out. Let's say it's 15,000 feet, I don't know. And just about 100 yards from me was my flight commander, a fellow called Norman Ryder, who was a wonderful fellow, and he'd done exactly the same. So if I'd done what my flight, I'd done the sensible thing, I reckon.